Hi, this is Kevin Sawatsky, and I took a left at the valley and ended up right where I was supposed to be.
Beautiful.
I know we shouldn't have to scream that we're atheists, you know, we don't have non-astrologers and all that, but with religious people taking over the world, I mean, we can either speak up or be pushed into a corner.
I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen, I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith, and unsubstantiated claims, that's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist.
Coming at you from backwards atmosphere, this is Left of the Valley. My name is Kevin, and I asked my mom why she stopped breastfeeding me. She said she just wanted us to be friends.
Oh my god.
Joining me as usual is a team who think "Don't kid yourself" is a great slogan for a condom company.
Yeah. That is the perfect slogan for a condom company.
That is actually a really good slogan.
She hates it when people can't let go of the past, especially debt collectors, Nancy.
Okay.
Yeah, she's usually hired by debt collectors to collect. And she described herself in three words, lazy. Christina.
I take offense to that. I don't know, I think I'd get the first word out.
I think that's funny.
And she thought balderdash meant a rapid receding hairline.
Is that not what it means?
Ladies, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Yes, it is.
Hope you had a great week.
Oh, we always have a great week.
I made it through the
one
week,
way or
so
the other.
It's good.
It's a good start.
I'm alive.
So today we'll be talking to our old friend Rich Lyons. And yeah. If you remember him, he was a one that...
I remember him.
Yeah,
the question
you mostly
is,
remember.
Do the three of you remember
him? I do, actually. I fully remember that show.
He was the one that suffered through us during a stone episode that we did in mid to late October last year. And today we'll be talking about his podcast. But first, let's do a little chit-chat, and we got lots of things to go through. Did you guys hear that the magnetic pole, the magnetic north pole of the Earth, is actually moving further north at an alarming rate? It's actually, scientists are actually baffled why it's doing that. A century ago, the magnetic north pole was on the north coast of Canada.
What?
Yes. It's not like the geographic North Pole, right? It's where the magnetic,
oh, the magnetic,
you know, where the compass actually points, right?
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was the North Pole.
No.
Like the peppermint stripe North Pole, where Santa is.
Thought the magnetic North Pole was at the exact North Pole.
No, it's not. Yeah. No, it's not, right?
It does kind of shift, though, doesn't it?
It does shift. It wasn't shifting so much between the 1900 to about 1980. Then it started shifting going north. And it's now moving, going to Russia. It's moving about 50 kilometers a year.
Wow.
What?
Yeah.
The Russians are stealing it.
It's aliens, guys. It's always aliens.
It's the Russians attacking on Facebook. Their ads, right? The military asked for a recent assessment because their GPS and their communication kind of depends on that. And it's affecting the navigation. So, and of course, the magnetic North Pole basically moves due to liquid iron inside the Earth that basically is shifting. And that right now, the pole, the magnetic pole itself is actually, like we said, is moving further up north.
So is the iron that's making it shift?
Yes.
Oh,
there's like liquid
the
iron inside the Earth, inside the crust, and that's what's causing the magnetosphere, if you wish, to be at that certain location. And come from that point like a big magnet, right, from one pole to the next. And it's, imagine if you get a sphere and you get a magnet bar inside, so it's shifting, you know, it's moving, and then right now it's heading towards Russia.
So I don't know whether you can answer this or not. Is that a normal function or is that an abnormal function?
I mean, I don't know, and I'm not sure scientists know either at this point.
Okay, because it's never, it's moving and nobody knows why, because there hasn't been intermittent shifts. It's just, this seems to be a constant shift.
Well, it seems to be a constant shift, but like I said, from 1900 to 1980, it really didn't move that much. I think now all of a sudden since 1980 it started going north more.
Yeah, it's
more and
the
more.
Speed with which it's moving.
Yeah,
now they're
and
saying
it's like
50 okay,
50 kilometers a year is a hell of a move yeah. too. When you think of something,
they're
like
kind of going, okay, something has happened here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Somebody tried to explain it to me like this. I'm not sure if they're correct or not, but he said, think of an orange, and let's say you peel the skin of an orange, but you leave it on top, mm-hmm. but the skin moves. But the top of the orange stays essentially where it is, but the skin's moving over top. Maybe mm-hmm. that's what's happening here. The crust essentially is floating over top, or the pole inside. Mm-hmm. So there's a misalignment, if you wish.
Oh, so I mean, there's no connection with something that might be man-made or global warming.
Not that we can tell. Not that we can tell.
Yeah,
and I'd be curious to see also if the South Magnetic Pole is yeah. essentially doing the same thing.
Yeah, anybody, any scientists out there who
this is
understand
we need
this,
Ethan Siegel.
Please let us know and come on the show and explain
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It sounds fascinating, doesn't it?
Did you guys hear there's a Princeton University study that points that seniors and conservatives are actually responsible for the fake news on Facebook.
Wow, I'm
it's
super
my fault.
Shocked.
It's my fault. Wait, it's my fault?
You might be a senior, but you're not a conservative.
No. Wow.
They are actually 7 times more likely than liberals to actually post something fake.
Yeah.
They studied 2,711 people that were interviewed, and they looked at 897 specific articles that were shared on the social media on Facebook. There were the seniors especially, and especially those that are conservative or ultra-conservatives, were 7 times more likely to post something fake as compared to the denomination between the 18 to 29 years old, and 3 times as much as between 30 to 44, and twice as much as between 45 to 64. So it seems as you're getting older, you're more likely to post fake news on the media.
But if you're a liberal, more to do with how the younger generation grew up with this technology mm-hmm. and understands it.
It's quite
whereas elderly people grew up in a world where your newspaper was edited by
and they assume automatically that it's true.
Exactly.
No, it's quite possible. And the funny thing is, in there too, is the study found out that the liberals, anybody that was quote unquote a liberal, shared no fake news like that.
Really?
Well, but you have liberal seniors.
Yes.
So you have conservative seniors and liberal seniors, but the more liberal you are or the more educated you are to the more more progressive mm-hmm. ideas and things, the less likely you are to fall for things that come from a fake source.
Exactly. And on a personal note, I've been having a lot of fights on Facebook this past week locally, especially regarding the yellow vest. Because there is the Yellow Vest movement in France, which is actually a legitimate movement, but there is kind of a quasi attempt to have a Yellow Vest movement here in Canada, but it's not the same thing as France. In France, the movement is legitimate, it's a movement of the people, but here, I will say, and this is my opinion, it's only my opinion, it's a hijacked movement by conservatives to try to get angry at Prime Minister Trudeau.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this week, some of their Facebook page from the Yellow Vest in Canada were actually removed because they were actually putting death threats to the Prime Minister.
Wow, guys, you're smart.
And, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I don't want to hear, like I said, it's my opinion, but even when we had a conservative Prime Minister, and I'm about as liberal as they get, and many on the spectrum there, I don't recall hearing a lot of death threats to Prime Minister Harper. So it's like all these people are saying, oh, there's just as many bad on the left as on the right. I'm sorry, that's not true. That's not true. And that study actually proves it right here. The conservative movement is dying, and humans are more progressive, like we've always said on the show for the longest time. So, and I think this is their last refuge, is to basically lie. And we see that in the States, so.
Yeah, I think so. I think when the generation, I don't think it's what do you call the generation that's around 30? Is it the millennials?
The millennials.
That are
millennials.
30 at this point.
And 20s
30
right
and younger. When they begin to be in their, I think in their 50s and so forth, I think we'll see mm-hmm. a shift. Although they say when people are liberal, in their youth, they become more conservative.
Yeah, they used to say that, but
age.
You know what?
But
I don't think with this
generation, it's going to be that way. I think the progressive ideology is going to dominate which is a good thing in terms of our outlook.
Yeah, I think personally the conservative movement, oh, we could do an entire show on this, but I think it's going to be self-destructive at some point, and it's just going to stop in this present incarnation. Did you guys hear that repeated radio signals are coming from the galaxy 1.5 billion light years away?
I haven't. Cool. Aliens. Always aliens.
They're radio signals, and they're repeating themselves, and they're essentially flashes that last only like milliseconds, but they have the same energy as apparently 12 months of sunlight, and they repeat themselves about 6 times now.
That's super cool.
Yeah, this was actually discovered by the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment that we've talked about before called CHIME, right here in BC, so... That's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on. It could be absolutely anything.
Yeah, it's probably caused by a natural
phenomenon. Most likely, especially when the signal is like milliseconds long. I mean, it's not... It's very unlikely that it's not like an intelligence or something like that. Yeah.
Still cool, though.
It is pretty cool.
It is cool.
If I was to say a robot killing a robot, would that be roboticide? there was the story about a Tesla car that mowed down an A1 robot at the CES Tech Show, which is the Consumer Electronics Show. There was a V4 humanoid robot that was actually just walking around, essentially in a demonstration, and a Model S Tesla, which was, you know, on self-driving mode, just ran right over it.
To be fair, it didn't like run over it. It kind of like clipped it on the side and it fell over.
Yeah.
Just because running over, you get a different picture.
So much for self-driving cars.
Yeah.
At least it makes me feel better for the eventual, like, machinery taking over the world, because they'll just infight. Like us.
Exactly. They'll just do what we do.
So do we have the first case of roboticide here in history?
I think so.
Some people say it was probably a publicity stunt. I'm not sure what kind of publicity we're seeing with this.
Was the robot, like, dead?
Apparently there was enough damage that the robot is not repairable.
So then that's definitely roboticide.
Well, Elon Musk is trying to stop the competition.
If it's on self-driving mode, it's not a remote control car.
No, it's not.
Maybe it just didn't register that there was something there.
Most likely that's what happened, right?
It's looking for people, not robots.
Well, no, it has to be looking for things as well, because if there's a garbage can in the road, it has to be able to like either stop or like go around it.
Just hit it. Just hit it.
Anyway, it sounds like a fun animated movie to me.
That would actually be.
Did you guys see there's a movie in the movie theaters right now called Vice about Dick Cheney?
You saw it.
I saw that.
I have not seen it.
It was a fantastic movie, actually. It was very well done. Mm-hmm. And actor Christian Bale completely takes over the role and disappears under the makeup, and he actually does a fantastic job. So he went to the Golden Globe. He got a Golden Globe, and he thanks Satan for inspiration to play the role.
Oh, I read that. I know. That's wonderful.
How did the Christians respond?
Well, how do you think they responded?
They were absolutely
they lost their shit, obviously.
Well, to be fair, don't they think Satan like runs the entertainment industry? So shouldn't for them this be like part of the course? Like,
yeah, but he apparently also runs a deep state. And, you know, was there anybody more deep state during the Bush administration than Dick Cheney? I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I just think that was just such a fun thing to say. It really was.
I just wonder how Christian Bale himself thinks about this, because I think it's almost flattering that you get so much of a go out of people for saying something like that. So
I would be honored.
And how does Satan? I mean, has Satan said
Satan anything? Was unavailable for comment, unfortunately.
Darn.
But he promised he'll get back to us.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear about this woman called Rahaf Al Quinun? I hope I'm pronouncing this right. She's a young 18-year-old from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia who was on vacation with her parents to Kuwait. And she fled, and she boarded another plane, and she was trying to reach Australia. But she got stranded at the Bangkok airport, where authorities tried to push her back onto the plane so she could go back to Kuwait. And she locked herself in a hotel room and basically went on social media, and this made news around the world. She said that she was an apostate and she was fleeing her parents and the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and she was afraid for her life. Well, Canada decided to step up, and Canada decided to accept her as a refugee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was
quite a few different countries that were considering it.
Yeah, she was kind of stranded there at the airport because apparently she met at some point a Saudi diplomat who seized her passport.
Yeah.
So then she was really kind of stranded there in Thailand. And
how old was she?
18.
Yeah. Can you imagine how scared?
Oh, yeah.
She obviously was a girl who was
brave and scared.
With a great deal of control, you know, and had to, mm-hmm. you know, watch her behavior all of the time. And here she, whatever it was in her mind that said, I can't live like this anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
And the chance that she took and how she, I don't know, maybe she planned it or at the last minute she had a, you know, a run for freedom, but we'll hear her story eventually.
Yeah.
It makes me so happy.
Apparently she landed this morning in Toronto.
Fantastic.
How much technology and social media can actually do for people.
Yeah.
Because imagine a world without Twitter.
Like, yeah.
She would have been forced back to Saudi Arabia and killed.
Absolutely.
And who would have known?
No one.
And exactly. And I can only hope that her story gives courage to more women that are in this position to maybe take that risk too. Mm-hmm. And also, I hope especially more that this story influences men in that country to say, well, this is ridiculous. We really should not have our women feel that way, that they feel like they're trapped. Although, you know, so maybe, I don't know, maybe this is the start of a reform for Islam in Saudi Arabia. Maybe I'm shooting way too high here, but
Saudi Arabia is just...
I'm just trying to be hopeful here.
Yeah,
I'm trying to be optimistic.
It's good to be hopeful, but we certainly wish her well. And
welcome to Canada.
Yes.
Welcome to Canada.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly. All right, well, before we go to our top 10, we got...
Yay!
I'm so excited.
I hope it's not bad.
Clues. We received a letter from Paul, and I screwed up yet again, and Paul is correcting me, and thank you, Paul. So he says, "Dear Left of the Valley, I would like to say that I enjoy your show very much and always look forward to the next new episode." By the way, he's from Australia.
Oh.
This is a listener from Australia. I must also tell you that in your December 16th episode, someone mentioned skating in Ottawa. And what we're looking for is the Rideau Canal, which is used for skating in the winter and not the hall of the Ottawa Hall River. And he's correct.
Huh.
So
fantastic.
And that was my mistake there, too.
How could you, Kevin?
I know. I feel so bad. I'm being corrected
Canadians.
By an Australian on my own country.
Yeah.
Twice. It's like, oof, this is humiliating. But you know what? He's correct. He's absolutely correct. Also, in the December 23rd, which was our Christmas special, Kevin insisted that Banff is in British Columbia. Kevin is called... Kevin, do your homework because Banff is, in fact, in Alberta. And he's right. He is right. Now, the mistake...
We know that. We misspoke. But thank you, Paul.
Hey, no,
yes.
It's in Alberta.
You were.
And I made that mistake, and I explained the mistake because Banff National Park is essentially on the border between...
Yes.
And when it crosses into... British Columbia, Banff National Park, it's still a national park, but it becomes under another name.
Yeah.
But the national park basically overshadows the border on both sides. So, but Banff, actually, the city of Banff is actually in Alberta. And that was completely my mistake.
No, I think we were talking. I think it was my top 10 that initiated that because we're talking about gifts to the world from Canada. So,
yes.
Paul, if you've been a visitor to Canada before, next time come on to British Columbia and we'll
absolutely.
Welcome you here on the show.
Paul, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Correcting my dumbass. I really appreciate that. So.
Yeah, that's great.
We love you, Paul.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, speaking of top 10, Nancy, you ready to go?
Yeah, I've got, I think a little different. Every week I say, I think I've got something a little different because I try to make them all different. But this is from a blog called Urge of Creativity. And it's the 10 best nonfiction books of all time to read before you die.
Ooh,
so this is a subjective list.
I'm
you
excited.
May have a different one, but this is a lot of food for thought. So we can go over them and see if you've read them or
probably
the
not.
Books that you
I'm
would like
not
to read.
Nonfiction.
The first one I bet you guys have heard about, but probably not read, except for me. I doubt whether you've read it. The number 10 book is A Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan.
I have not.
And this is a book that when it came out, when it was published in 1963, the women that I knew who were in their 30s and 40s and had lived the life of being a housewife, mm-hmm. or going to college and having their education interrupted, or being told, you know, you've got a choice. You can be a secretary, you can be a teacher, you can be a nurse, but if you try to be anything else, it's an uphill climb. So we were brought up in the 50s, and by 1963, many of us, you know, had put the dreams aside, mm-hmm. and were raising our children. And when we read The Feminine Mystique, it was explosive. And we thought, maybe this is something that we could maybe become something more than we were. And I was a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church at that time, and groups of us read the book and had it in our laps and had these discussions, mm-hmm. and I can't tell you how powerful this book was. That's to so try cool. and could... educate us to, you know, sexism and feminism and trying to, you know, trying to break out of the mold and become who we were. It was so powerful.
I can just picture you at that age, you know, saying, I'm not going to be a secretary, a nurse.
I'm going to be an assassin.
Right. That's right, God damn it. It's an uphill battle, but I don't care.
I think we all thought of the same thing as we were going through that. I'm like, that's when Nancy decided to become an assassin.
That's right. That's when I started looking for Uzis. You know, instead of shopping for bikinis, I was at the gun store looking for Uzi. But even though it's dated, and even though it's 1963, when you read that book, you really understand the movement of feminism and how important it was, mm-hmm. to our life. It's really
good selection.
I doubt whether you'll really read it, but it is one that, you know, you can see the elements of revolution.
Yes.
You know, on every page. It was a fabulous book. Anyway, going on from that, number 9 is by Maya Angelou, called I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Okay.
If you haven't read anything by Maya Angelou, this is very autobiographical, but her life and her poetry and her expression about life and about racism and things like that are just, they're poetic. Mm. They're just beautiful. So anything by Maya Angelou is worth reading, that's for
is
sure.
Is she still with us, or is she gone now?
No, she's gone.
Yeah, she's gone. She's gone. I thought so.
Yeah. But that's 2 women in a row. So number 8 will take in a male author, the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Oh,
by Alex Haley.
Well, that's been interesting.
And Malcolm X. Yeah, he was an explosive figure, a polarizing figure in his time. And, you know, human rights, mm-hmm. A human rights activist. And there have been books and movies written about him. So to understand, you know, the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. People really should read.
What a lot of people don't realize is every peace movement has the polar opposite in the same movement, right? Martin Luther King had Malcolm X. Gandhi had, there was a more violent option. I think his name was Singh something. I forget the name, but, you know, every movement, and this is why, you know, eventually the authorities would rather deal with the peaceful one than deal with the more violent one. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the, anyway, it's a subject of we could shoot a board one of these days.
Yeah, well, this also, Alex Haley interviewed Malcolm X from 1963 to 1965. Mm-hmm. So that was the era of the 60s, where everybody was saying we can be something better, something different, if we confront mm-hmm. society the way it is and try to move on from the prejudices.
And 60 years later, they have no problems with racism in the States, right?
No. We conquered everything in the 60s.
Obama was black. That's it. That solves everything.
Yep. Okay, number 7, The Second World War by Winston Churchill.
Oh,
so
wow.
And so that gives
I didn't know
you,
when Churchill wrote a book.
He portrayed the period from the end of the First World War to July 1945. And it's a beautiful book. I haven't read it. And he used his own notes and scribbles along with some official documents. but the book was his point of view, so you don't get, you know, an objective viewpoint about the era of that time. But it still got the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953.
And if you rather want to take a quick look also at Winston Churchill through movies instead of the book, which of course I recommend you go for the book, but there's also this very nice movie with Gary Oldman playing Churchill called The Darkest Hour.
Oh, that's right.
Which is actually a very, very, very good look into Churchill as well.
Yeah. Number six, The Civil War, a narrative by Shelby Foote. So if you've ever, if you've seen the Civil War on PBS, the documentary, Shelby Foote narrates in that, and he's a beautiful storyteller. And for those Americans, it gives you an in-depth portrait of, you know, where we were and why we are where we are, where the U.S. is now. So it's a extremely well-written book for insight and knowledge about the American Civil War. Anything Shelby Foote wrote is worth reading if you like history. That's not everybody's game, but
no,
you know, these are books, nonfiction books, that will stimulate you and educate you in one way or the other. So that's always a good one. Number five, A Brief History of Time. I've been waiting for that because I knew you'd get a good response from that one.
Which I believe I have.
Have you read that one?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. What did you think of it, Christina?
I loved it. I really enjoyed it. His ability to translate his excitement of the world and the universe.
And let's face it, when you were reading it, you were reading it with the voice of the computer, right?
No.
No, I was. I was imagining Hawking saying the book, but in his voice, you know.
No, I wasn't.
But that, I should read it again and have that in my mind.
Yeah, there have been four editions of that book, and it's well.
I have it here.
Yeah, what a personal story as well as the scientific, you know, background and knowledge, you know, that there isn't, you know, in that guy for sure. Number four, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
Oh.
That book has gotten, you know, accolades from so many different areas, and, you know, from literature and also, you know, from history, and the way he transcribed the book, you know, how he did it personally. And he did it with Harper Lee, who wrote
To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yep. And they were friends.
Oh, really?
Because they're both Southern. Not that they were both Southerners, so they had to be friends, but they had a lot in common. So this was in 1959. And it deals with the murders of four members of a family living in Kansas. So he flew to Kansas with Harper Lee. They investigated the case, and they talked to neighbors and peoples and gathered the details. And they worked on it for 6 years, and he published it in 1966. And if you're a fan of crime and true events, you mustn't miss it. And then they made a movie of it as well, but it was a break from Truman Capote to do a real crime story rather than fiction.
Interesting.
So yeah, it is, and it's one of those things that if you do have time to read it, you'll be well rewarded by the writing and by the details. Because when he interviewed, he didn't sit there with pen and paper because he knew that it would interfere with his rapport with the killers, and so he memorized everything, and then after the interviews, wrote everything down. Just interesting how he did it. Number three, this is before your time.
All of these are before our
Black
time.
Black Boy.
Sorry, say that again.
Yeah.
The title.
Pardon?
What's the title?
Black Boy by Richard Wright.
Oh.
This was a book that was written in 1945, and it's basically an autobiography based on his childhood and young adulthood, and it deals with his encounters with extreme racism, violence, and how that influenced his entire life. And it starts with a rebellious boy burning down his grandmother's house and ends with him trying to start a revolution through his writing. It was the first book that I read that had to do with racism, and I was brought up in Chicago, where you did see a lot of black people in my neighborhood. They were the maids. They were the cleanup people. And I had no idea about anything having to do with racism or people of color or how they negotiated. And it was a stunning book for a young girl to read. I think I read it in the 50s when I was about 12 or 13. And I didn't understand all of it. But it was a very powerful book. And I think it's still... would ring, you know, true at this point to see, okay, this is the way the world was in 1945. How far or how, you
how
know,
has it changed?
You know, how if I could get my tongue working, great. But not how far that we've come. So it's an interesting book for comparison. Number two, The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank.
I think we're all reminded. Read this.
Yeah, it's so sad. Yeah. It's
See,
just so
my issue is I am already, like, really depressed. So it's like I try to use reading as, like, an escape from the world. So it's really hard to read biographical stuff that's depressing because it just makes me, like, not happy.
Yes.
I mean, she, you know, she had hope. And, you know, to read in real time, you're really almost in that attic. You're in that... That spot with her, you're just sitting with her, and you know the ending, but you just you know you wish that it hadn't happened. It's a very sad book, but it's a good one to read. Number one, believe it or not, according to this blogger, is The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud.
Really?
I don't know whether I put that one as number one or not, but it's interesting.
Well, I could see the value of this book as to you're essentially the baby steps of psychology.
Yeah, but so much has been improved on it.
Yes, but
he got so much wrong.
Yeah, but I'm not saying look at the book as a reference manual. Look at it as a historical novel in a way how they were trying to unlock the secrets of the mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see that value.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, 1899.
Yeah.
And it still holds up. You know, it has gotten somewhat controversial, and not everybody believes it, but as the basis of psychology and how people negotiate themselves, you know, in the world through the explanation of their dreams, it's really a fascinating book for its time. So anyway, according to Freud, our dreams are our own unfulfilled desires that we attempt to fulfill in our own unconscious mind. So, anything that
I
that
have
has
some
to do with psychology,
weird desires. Then.
that's the granddaddy of the books. So,
if you don't like that book from Freud, maybe I'd recommend The Origins of Species from Darwin.
Yeah.
You know,
actually, that would make more sense.
Or if you
not
are,
more sense,
or,
but that should be enough.
Or if you are fascinated by psychology, which I am, just read a newer book about psychology.
No. So any books that you've read or want to read that you think should be on a bucket list of books to read?
Well,
goodness gracious. Where to start?
There's if we're nonfiction, I have no idea.
I think a book that I read recently, which I think doesn't get a lot of credit and really should, especially in this day and age and our political realm as we stand, The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, which really shows that, you know, the world is not going to shit. It's not. Mm-hmm. The facts are that we are right now living in the best times in our history ever, and it's improving, and the numbers show it, and Pinker does a remarkable job with that book. And it's one of those, because you hear it all the time, oh, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, especially from Christians, you know, we're atheists, we see it all the time, Armageddon's always around the freaking corner again, you know, get the 9th Armageddon, your 10th one is free.
I have a few punch sheets already.
But when you read that book and you look at the numbers and you take into account history as it was, and yeah, we truly are. I mean, think about it this way. We are one of maybe two generations right now on this show, and you guys are probably the second or the third generation, I would say, that has never actually had to go to war. And any generation before that, that was a fact of life. You would go to war at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, because for us, people choose to enlist.
Yeah.
Today, there are some people...
Today, to go in the army is the only way to go to college. To go to war is a choice by a country. But back then, it was an inevitable fact of life. You know, you were going to... In medieval times, you were going to end up in battle. Well, you know? Yeah. Before that, any time before that. So, anyway, we could go on and off on everything.
Though, for us as women, this is the first generation we've been allowed to.
Yeah,
if we want
that
to.
Too. Yeah. So, thank you, Nancy. That was a great list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good list. Anybody that has books that you think would add to the list, send them. Come on, Paul. We're waiting for you to send in your send in your recommendations.
I think the only non-biographical story I've ever can remember reading, like about someone's life, was Glass Castle. And that spoke to me on a deep level because I also
I'm not familiar with that book.
It's a woman who came from a very like troubled home and childhood, and her family was just messed up. And I'm like, I understand.
Yeah, there's a lot of book about the what things women had to go through. The recent one I read was from Ayaan Rashid Ali, Infidel. Mm-hmm. And that's which is her story, and you know it's wow. She went through a lot. So she'd be a great guest on our show too.
Yeah,
as you never know. All right, my dear Kirsten, you ready for another brilliant moment?
I sure am.
Do you buy religion?
That's right.
All right. So you would think that Christians would jump at the chance to see their savior represented in popular media, right?
Of course.
Of course.
But. Some believers are a tad upset about the portrayal of Jesus in the new series from DC Comics.
Is he a superhero or villain?
Wait, hold on a sec. DC Comics?
Yeah.
It was like a Superman versus Jesus?
I wonder who would win.
The premise is actually pretty great. The superhero is Jesus, but he comes back to Earth only to set the record straight after seeing how many people have twisted his words.
This is amazing!
That's brilliant!
The series, called Second Coming, and written by Mark Russell with art by Richard Pace...
I want to read this.
...comes out in March, just in time for Easter.
Oh my gosh, I want to read this.
I know. According to comic book resources... Russell mixed in his own idea of Christianity in the animated work by claiming that Jesus needed to return to Earth to learn how to become the true Messiah from a Superman-like character called Sun Man.
You know what?
That sounds so good.
That would be so great if it actually happened, because you could see Jesus come in and say, guys, I said I don't like figs. Not fags. Figs. Figs, guys. Come on. That's brilliant. I love it.
Witness the return of Jesus Christ as he is sent on a most holy mission by God to learn what it takes to be the true Messiah of mankind by becoming roommates with the world's favorite savior, the all-powerful superhero Sun Man.
Could you imagine Jesus trying to learn Twitter?
No, just let me finish. The all-powerful superhero Sun Man, the last son of Crispex.
Crispex.
Oh my God.
But when Christ returns to Earth, he's shocked to discover that he has what has become of his gospel, and now he aims to set the record straight, the comic description reads.
You know what? If Jesus was anything the man he was depicted at in the Bible, he would be shocked.
Yeah.
At being back today. And he would probably go to the U.S. and be labeled a terrorist.
The first thing, I'm not white, guys. I'm not white.
That's right. And then he'd be probably thrown into, oh, what is this hippie and, you know, this socialist trying to turn.
I know, right?
Oh, Kirsten, when it comes out, you're going to have to get a copy of it.
Oh, yes.
Do a review.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to do that.
Yeah.
That's such a great cover.
You're looking at a picture of
He's putting a loaf of bread in someone's mouth. While Sun Man, like, chokes someone out.
Oh, I just
It's
love
hilarious.
It. I'm looking forward to that.
A buddy cop comedy with Jesus. That'd be great.
Pretty much. Like, that's what the cover looks like.
Could
it's
you
hilarious.
Imagine... them setting Jesus in front of YouTube and him just like falling down like the YouTube
rabbit hole
him
ending up on like watching like Rick and Morty.
No.
This is probably where my gun would start.
I think he'd be happy to if he stopped at Rick and Morty. Yeah. Alrighty, moving on. And I'm kind of looking forward to that coming out.
Oh my gosh, me too.
For sure.
I should pre-order it.
A woman wrote to the 700 Club on Wednesday to ask Pat Robertson...
The 700 Club? Oh, hold on. Let me get comfortable with this.
For advice about the gay porn she found on her 13-year-old son's iPad, because he's really the expert. Here's what she wrote. Hello, Pat and friends. I was doing my weekly technology checkup on my 13-year-old son's iPad computer when I noticed homosexual pornographic material in his search history.
Oh, kid!
This has greatly shaken my family. This has greatly shaken my family and my connection to God. How can we stop my son's homosexual interests? Emma.
Oh, God, don't do conversion therapy.
How can
therapy.
We stop?
Whatever you do, don't do conversion therapy. Oh, my God, is he going to say do conversion?
No. Stop and I'll finish the story.
Okay, sorry.
She's almost, I can almost picture her with a bag of popcorn hiding under the covers. No. Oh my God, how is it going to turn out?
No. She'll have the paper bag hyperventilating.
Yeah, because conversion, like, your kid's going to kill himself. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Robertson's response began decently enough, talking about how boys that age will be curious, and then descended into chaos.
You should do it with the voice. The boys that age are going to be
Have you actually
curious.
Watched the 700 Club, Kirsten?
No.
Oh, you are lucky. I grew up on it.
Oh, you
poor thing. I'm not surprised.
Yep, on Joy TV.
Why would I want to watch it?
Yeah, true enough.
Well, look, kids are curious about all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old boys, they're interested in all kinds of things, so they're exploring stuff. I think, how can you stop it? I think what you need to do is to cut off that particular avenue that's coming into him, because somebody's trying to seduce your son and they shouldn't be sending homosexual or any other kind of sexual material on the internet.
Does he understand
it shouldn't
how Google
be
works?
Done.
I thought he was going to say, when you went to cut off, I had a different picture in my mind. I thought, oh my God, no, he's not going there.
The one that caught me is a particular avenue that's coming into him. Yeah, that's right.
But is it out there? Yes. How do you stop it? Well, you really need to find some technological way of cutting the cord on that one, because that's not good for him or you.
He really doesn't understand who Google works.
And he didn't blame it on demons? I mean, he's a little off his stride.
He's probably getting to that. He's probably warming up to that.
Boy views porn on the internet. Pat Robertson thinks boy is being groomed to be an actual gay. Or by an actual gay man. Not even in the same ballpark on that one. But this is what happens when you ask for tech advice from an 88-year-old man.
He can't be 88. He's got to be like 8,800.
Exactly.
Well, it's just talking about this.
They thaw him out of a fridge every
week. This current life of 88. So, the problem isn't the kid looking up sexual material online. I promise you that's going to happen. And the kid will eventually learn how to clear his browser history.
Or
incognito. The problem here, the bigger problem I see, is the mother doing a weekly technology checkup on her son that involves going through that browser history.
Wait.
He's 13, and there's a lot of stuff he's going to look up that mom's better off not knowing about.
Is that bad to do to your kid?
What?
Well,
I would be such a helicopter parent. What? I would be doing daily. I'd be like, okay, what are you doing online?
Okay.
I have to explain this more, though.
No.
Okay.
Let me talk about...
Okay, sorry.
Okay, I'm going to just interrupt my own story here. What we're going to do is we're going to educate any said children that we may or may not have on proper internet safety.
Yes. Because for me, I'd be terrified that they would actually be getting groomed online. Because
we're not.
I've experienced that, and it's like horrifying. And it's like, don't do that. Don't talk.
We're not going to do what this lady's, what it seems like this lady is doing, and just going through his browser history every single week to see everything that he's been doing. Because honestly, that's just going to create a whole lot of trust issues if there isn't any already.
If you find anything questionable, you can talk to your kid about it. Like, hey, like, what were you trying to find? Like, why did you go into this? And like, if they're like, oh, you know, I was trying to look up this thing, and you can use it as a topic starter, and you can talk with your kids about the sex talk and stuff like that.
And use it to open up avenues and create
not
trust.
Like,
not just going through their stuff. Never just go through your kids' stuff.
What percentage of parents overall do you think go through their children's browsers and check their internet
I don't think it's a lot.
Connections. Do you think like 20% of the parents? Do you think mostly religious parents? Do you think parents who really want to establish trust and say, I'm letting you know that you've got your smartphone or you've got your tablet, but here are the restrictions because you're too young to understand these things unless we can explain them to
you. There's definitely boundaries that you need to have.
I think tech-savvy parents are more likely to go through.
Yeah.
People that are not tech-savvy
don't understand how to do... Especially, I think this generation coming up understands the dangers of the internet.
Yeah.
And how easily things can be taken advantage of.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like, because the thing is, going through the browser history isn't really good telling, because like, especially kids can be taken advantage of on apps like Instagram and Snapchat. Like those, like people who are trying to actually take advantage of your kids understand technology, know how to get to your child.
Yeah.
You know the irony.
Where they are.
You know the irony in all this? Is while she's doing this, the kid's going through his mother's internet browser, and he says, the 700 Club? Really? You think about me being taken advantage of?
Yeah.
Come on.
Pretty much.
You're giving the money to a freaking
outfit. So overall, you're not against?
No.
I know it sounds like
restricting or making or having boundaries for children?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Because
up to what age?
For me,
I think it depends on the maturity of the child.
I would continue doing it, honestly, until they moved out. Like, well, until they were like, no, okay, let me explain this. Till they were like 17, 18, like until they were an adult, but I would do it differently at different ages, but I would always keep the communication with what that child is doing online. I wouldn't, like, if they're 16.
Oh, I would have hated you at my mother. That's my
yeah.
mother.
Yeah. Oh, but again, I like, to be fair, like, I, as someone who has, I've been taken advantage online before myself. So I am terrified of a child going through that experience. So I would be so hyper-vigilant.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, no, don't talk to anyone.
Fair enough.
If we ever have kids, it's going to be an interesting roller coaster ride. I'm going to tell you that one.
Just as long as she doesn't pull away his iPad and give him a Bible, I think that kid will be fine.
When a child's older, say when they're 15 or like 14, 15, I'm not going to be like going through their history. I'll talk to them and I'll like make sure that if they're talking to people online, they know who they are.
Yeah.
That they're not talking to random strangers or people who are like liking their photo and being like, oh my gosh, you're so like cool and awesome, because people who actually want to take advantage of your kid will pretend to be kids same age and get to know them, and then it's horrifying.
And I just want to say, I'm not against like
monitoring
what your kid's doing. I'm just saying, first of all, you should educate them on like the shit that goes on in our world, and also like do it in a way where you're keeping that communication open and not like just taking it and going through their history, or just doing it behind their back and then just like waiting for them to be like, I looked at this and you've been looking at this, so do you want to talk about that? And like bombarding
also
them with
because
that.
And if your kid,
it can be difficult because you have, you know, kids say 13 to 14 15, they just mentally don't understand the danger at all.
Yeah,
you can explain it to them. It's so foreign to their understanding, and it is. They don't, you know, the power of sex and the power.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They just can't comprehend it yet.
For a lot of different reasons, they're just oblivious and trying to explain how dangerous it is. You know, it's like they don't really understand.
Yeah. And I think
how they can be hurt by it.
Your child talk to like I personally am I encourage anyone with children to get them counseling, even if they don't have like an obvious like need for it. Just having them able to talk to someone outside of their home that they can share things with always helps. Mm-hmm. And then if they are getting into a sticky situation that they don't feel comfortable sharing with you, they can share with a counselor. And I feel sorry for any of my children.
Especially because they'll understand that with the counselor, that is a safe spot.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, ladies, for that.
Wow, that took an interesting turn, didn't it?
It took a left for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let's put that on pause. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Rich Lyons about his podcast. And hopefully he'll forgive us for the treatment we gave him last
night. Hey, I was wonderful. I was wonderful.
So stay with us.
Hi, I'm God. And I just want to make sure to tell you not to listen to Unapologetics on Stitcher and SoundCloud. That's Unapologetics with an X at the end. But, yeah, definitely do not listen to the show. I mean, I swear to me, alright, I will murder my son. I kind of already did that, but, just don't listen to the show, okay? Hey, Lucy.
Can you not call me that, okay? We already went over what my name is, okay? It's Lucifer.
Alright, look, Luce. You want to come with me? I'm going to go fuck with this guy, Joe.
No, don't do that, okay? Can you just leave him alone?
Yeah, I'm gonna kill his family.
No, don't do that.
I'm gonna give him sores all over his body.
Don't do that. That's disgusting.
And, I'm gonna kill all of his livestock.
Stop saying things. Just stop.
And I'm gonna blame the whole thing on you. All right, let's go, bud. Remember, don't listen to Unapologetics on Stitcher and SoundCloud.
Hey, definitely listen to that show. It's awesome. It's really cool. He's really a dick.
I heard that.
In a world torn apart by a lack of reason.
Or least.
And I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt. And I claim that right.
In the morning.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert Stanley from the Right to Reason podcast. And if you subscribe now, you'll get free.
Learn more about the broadcast at therighttoreason.com.
God wants, and I know what he says in his book. I have access to a higher authority. Now, what I want you, I'll ask, how does he know that? And by what right does he claim to know the mind of God? And if you were a serious spiritual person, wouldn't you think it was a bit much that someone said they could come before you and tell you what God wanted?
Joining us back is our old friend Rich Lyons and
Hello.
With his co-host Deanna for live streaming without pants on. Oh, guys, thank you for joining us at Left of the Valley.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You say that now. Rich, first of all, I'm going to profusely apologize for last time.
We had a great time last time.
We did.
Well, we did, but the thing is, I was so out of it because your name is Rich Lyons that I started calling you Ryan instead. And I was putting the two together.
Answering to it.
Yes.
Yeah, but Kevin, the point of the whole show was how people react when they're stoned, and you were stoned, and Rich and I, got along beautifully, and I think it was the best part of the show. What do you think, Rich? Didn't we have a fun?
Oh, that was a great show. That was as much fun as I've had on the radio in a long time.
Yeah,
I just want to say hi, Rich. I'm finally aware.
Oh, hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Wasn't so great you didn't have a hangover after all that fun?
Right.
It was. I had a great sleep, though. I went home and passed out and had a 10-hour nap.
I guess I got to thank you and Nancy for saving our bacon for that show. That's for sure. And we really appreciate that. But today we are going to talk to you and your partner, Deanna, about your show called Life After Faith. So maybe you guys will be so kind for our audience that might not be aware of you guys. Give us a brief bio about who Rich and Deanna are.
Well, Living After Faith, actually, Life After Faith is a book by somebody who I think is still a believer. So we don't want to send our listeners astray.
How could you, Kevin?
Another one of my blunders. I've been doing nothing but that lately.
And you don't even have the excuse.
Yeah, I'm thinking I should start taking drugs. Maybe that'll just make me feel better and I'll be actually on cue. Okay, guys, bio. Let's find out who Rich and Diana are.
Okay,
Diana.
So
Diana.
After faith.
Fuck! Jesus Christ! Sorry.
Definitely need more drugs. I mean, it's in your defense, it's very early in the morning right now, so. So the Living After Faith show is, it started as Rich just telling his experience, leaving this fundamentalist Pentecostal religion. And, you know, he sat down on the mic and would just start talking about what he was going through. And it's morphed into a show where we talk about as many aspects of living after faith that we possibly can. You know, we try to cover, you know, ways that our thinking changes, the ways that our lives change, the brand new attitudes that we bring to life when we leave a religion. And we've had so many wonderful people on the show over the year to share their experiences. It's been super, super interesting. And we've got a new project right now, which we are so excited. We're just in the launch phase, and it's the After Faith Network. And once I get the website working, it'll be at afterfaith.net. But just heads up, my tech skills are not real quick right at the moment. And what we'll have is we'll have three different shows, maybe four, actually, now that I think about it. Let's see. We'll have Living After Faith.
Yes.
I am recording today a new show based on the same theme called Loving After Faith, where we'll talk about love and relationships and sex and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And then there is Jerry DeWitt's joining us with the After Faith Network.
The best hair in atheism, Jerry DeWitt.
Yep. The guy with the good hair. He's doing the Hope After Faith Between the Pages, where he takes some pages from his book and he'll read and talk about what he was going through at the time in the life in his life that he was writing about. And so, you know, intimate little looks into more detail from his Hope After Faith book. And then we're all three together doing a monthly NPR-style storytelling kind of show where we'll follow a theme and have interviews and some hip music and narration, kind of similar to what you would hear on This American Life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Ambitious.
That's hope after all.
Yeah. So I got to ask, with all these projects, why the hell would you come to the bottom of the barrel Lift of the Valley show to do an interview?
We're wonderful.
This is practice for them. It's practice for the real thing. So, Deanna, we heard about Rich's background when he was on the show, but what's your background?
When I was a kid, my parents used to drag us to a local Methodist church. It was, you know, one of those upper middle class, mellow, you know, we welcome everyone kind of churches. But then I got to have a wild experience with some, I guess you'd call them charismatic evangelicals. I hate to say franchise because that sounds like a business, but I think that's actually right, is it was a Vineyard franchise church. And so they're real big on the music. I ended up leaving home as a teenager and got stuck in a foster home with these incredibly insistent evangelicals. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody talk about ex-gay things. They were real big on sending somebody away to some sort of camp type thing, and they would try to pray away the gay. And, you know, I was I think I was like a 14 or 15 year old. I knew I was bisexual, but I didn't like have any, you know, experience, and I didn't know that really that's what I was and it was okay yet. You know, I was still real young and formative. So here I am stuck in this foster home with these people that forced me to go to church three times a week.
Oh my gosh.
And they're talking about, you know, praying the gay away. And I'm like terrified they're going to do it to me, you know. So after that experience, I started thinking a lot more about religion and just kind of slowly throughout the years realized I thought everybody was full of shit. I don't think any religions, any God beliefs, any supernatural claims have any merit to them. And so here I am just reading and learning as much as I can and making shows about a topic I'm passionate about.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. And then and you essentially teamed up with Rich and now history was made, essentially. And how long have you guys been going on the show?
We started in 2010, late 2010.
Wow.
We took about a five-year sabbatical after 2013, and we're back ramped up with about 20-plus new episodes. So we were here, and then we were gone, and now we're here again.
Wow.
Well, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, so essentially, yeah, you guys have plenty of experience. You're not like the new kids around the block. So maybe I should ask, in your time, I don't know if you guys can make some kind of compilation, but have you seen much changes in the movement from when you guys started in 2010 as to what we're living right now?
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started.
Well, I want to get you started. That's the whole point of the interview.
Oh, okay, good. I'll get started then. So when I first started getting into atheist movement stuff, it was like a lot of people right after 9/11, and you had people writing books and speaking out and using the terms atheist and, mm-hmm. you know, starting to talk about the very real and very in-your-face harm of like extreme religions, because that was, you know, very much what 9/11 attacks were about. And then, you know, from that, of course, everybody started expanding, talking about religion in our society. And, you know, a lot of new atheists like me were trying to say, hey, y'all, it's not just Muslim mm-hmm. people from some scary foreign country. Mm-hmm. This is religious extremism is a problem everywhere and in many different flavors. So that was, I started, you know, listening to the Atheist Experience show. I was listening to tons of podcasts. I read books. And, you know, when we decided that we were going to start Living After Faith, there was nothing else really like it in the market. I don't think at that time the, what is the board for pastors who don't believe?
Clergy Project.
The Clergy Project wasn't around yet. No, it hadn't
started. It was a year later that the Clergy Project started.
Yeah. And so, you know, the movement was very big and growing in its voice. You know, there wasn't a lot of people, but you had meetups starting up, groups everywhere, people online, and tons of podcasts. And then, you know, over the years, there's been a lot of stress within the movement because people have kind of split off into several different camps. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the rise of the alt-right in the U.S. was in part aided by many of those who would call themselves skeptics and atheists. And, you know, you had a lot of personalities kind of splitting off into their own camps. And it's been quite the mess. Now, we are very much on the social justice liberal side of the divides. We try to get along with everybody, but we do not tolerate Nazis. And so apparently that makes us like some kind of weird extremists.
Really? You don't tolerate Nazis?
Yeah, I know. It's the strangest thing. I don't understand it, but that's where we are as a movement right now. But we have tons and tons of wonderful people doing great work all over the place. There's a lot of humanists doing projects like the Foundation Beyond Belief, where they fund charity work. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of good going on. So we have to remind ourselves sometimes that it's not all just a quagmire of people being jerky to each other and arguing and calling theists stupid. And, you know, there's a lot of good, positive work going on. And so we try to just focus on that.
That's awesome.
Yes, that is awesome. And I think you bring up a very good point here when you say part of the rise of the alt-right was in part fueled by the skeptic movement as well. Because essentially the skeptics were also calling the left to be actually put forward what they were sustained their words, essentially. And I think the alt-right essentially took advantage of that because, of course, they don't care about whatever's true or not, right? So yeah. that was an interesting point you made there, and I don't think it's one that we've actually explored before. But anyway, let's move on to something else. So when you talk about it, you do interviews and you talk about Jerry DeWitt and all that, there are a lot of other names that we should know that you guys have interviewed in the past?
We've interviewed a lot of people in the past. Jerry is a partner with us in the Hope After Faith or the After Faith Network. So Jerry is a partner. He and I were Pentecostal pastors at about the same time, about 100 miles apart from each other.
Really?
We never met when we were Pentecostal pastors, but we got to know each other as atheists. And it's funny because, you know, he'd be, oh, I was pastoring in DeRidder. And I'm like, whoa, I was pastoring in Marshall. And, you know, how we didn't run into each other as fellow United Pentecostal churchers is beyond both of us because we had mutual friends, but we never met each other. So, of course, we talk with Jerry DeWitt fairly often now. As far as guests we've had on. I'm trying to think. I know we've had P.Z. Myers.
Oh, really? My God.
We've had Steve Shives.
How about Daryl Ray?
Daryl Ray. Times.
We started a lot with Daryl Ray. We were actually at one time the official podcast of Recovering After Religion.
Oh, nice.
And Daryl Ray, back in the first, before we reinvented ourselves here in the last year, well, we were the official podcast of Recovering From Religion. So we've had Daryl Ray on numerous times. He's
a great guy. Well, yeah, we have too.
I hope you guys can get that mantle back. That'd be great.
Oh, that would be fun. We'll have to think about it.
Yeah, it's something we haven't really wanted to pick up on. We want to be independent and do our own thing this go around.
Well, because if you decide to go for it, just tell Daryl that if he doesn't do it, he'll have to do an interview with us again. And he might say, okay, fine. I capitulate. I'll give it to you. No, we love Daryl.
Oh, we love Daryl Ray. We're just doing our own thing this go around. We worked the thing with them the first go around, and that was exciting and good for everyone. But this is just our own attempt to see what we can do on our own.
I'm glad that you say you and Jerry worked together, Jerry DeWitt, because I met Jerry DeWitt several years ago. He was nothing short but a Southern gentleman to me. He was a fantastic guy. You know, super polite. All you had to do is put him in white clothing or something like that, and curled off, and he would totally fit it, right? He's like, oh, I can totally believe it. He was wearing a blazer and everything. He was a great guy, and we had him on the show, what, 2 years ago?
Something like that.
We need to bring him back. We need to find a reason to bring him back. So, excellent. So, your show is back on, and you guys are rolling ahead. Is there anything you guys were looking forward in the future, some of the guests you need to bring on?
What we're doing now that we've got such a broad platform, we've got the daily show with Jerry, mm-hmm. we've got two monthly shows and a weekly show. Living After Faith is the weekly show. Mm-hmm. With it, we're trying to broaden our base a little bit and maybe even do multiple interviews in a single episode where we can take a topic and have several people from different perspectives on the topic mm-hmm. come on. And that's something that we're really looking forward to now, is being able to, rather than just have a single interview and the show be a single interview show, which we'll still do some of that, of course, mm-hmm. And there'll be always be interviews in the shows, but it'll be a chance and an opportunity for us to add more people and get a little deeper into the subjects that we do cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you guys need a Canadian perspective, we'll be more than happy to lend our voice to your show.
Thank you so much. We need to have you guys on. Actually,
so you guys,
when we get down here, we should schedule
7.
A time to record and have you guys on us.
Yeah. You, like Nancy said, you guys are busy like 24/7 all these shows. My God, where do you put all the time in there? That's a lot of work.
I think a lot of it is our inherent laziness. We like to actually get things done by doing sort of a set it and forget it method, to steal a phrase from one of those food companies advertising on TV in the 80s. So, you know, things like our Twitter feeds and our uploads, I like to set everything up so that you don't have to mess with it ever again. Mm-hmm. So websites, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of working on that with this incarnation, but the principle is to do the most with the least amount of action, i.e. laziness.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah,
I can totally understand that. Guys, in the current political climate that the United States are in, how do you guys feel about the future of atheism? You think we have a bright future? Because a lot of people are depicting a pretty negative image right now. Where do you guys stand there?
You know, right now, we've got this faux evangelism or faux evangelicals. Trump is not an evangelical. No. Trump is, I doubt, even a Christian.
No, he's human.
He's using the evangelicals and the church as a political tool. Mm-hmm. And I think right now they're getting a lot of coverage because politics and religion are working together, so they're getting a lot of coverage. I really think long-term atheism is growing, and atheism is eventually going to overtake the church as to which is larger. Mm-hmm. Atheism is the largest growing religion, if you want to call it a religion. They do for statistical purposes. So for stats, Atheism is the largest growing belief system is a word I choose mm-hmm. and like better. So still in the U.S., atheism is the largest growing belief system. The churches are seeing steady decline, very strong decline, especially as the millennials just turn their back on the church. So where the church goes from here, I think the church has to do some very serious restructuring, or they're going to just fade to a very minor background.
I totally agree.
Not a powerhouse, just fade back to something the way, kind of like, you know, you still occasionally do see a horse and buggy every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to go to the, you know, the Chevy dealership and try to invest in a horse and buggy, you know, it's just not, your whole system's not going to work. They don't have pooper stations. They don't have all the stuff that used to have back in the horse and buggy days. So it's just pooper not going to work, but they'll still have religion, but we'll look at it like a horse and buggy. Oh, isn't that quaint? Isn't that cute? Wow. They still keep a horse around. That's so sweet. And, that'll be about the effect that it has. I really think that's where it's headed.
I'm sorry. I've enough from now on. I will always equate evangelical
with
pooper station.
That's just brilliant.
So,
well, there's a lot of horse shit going around on that side.
Yes, for sure.
So in your show, what has been the most exciting topic that you guys have really enjoyed?
Yeah.
As far as, let me tell you about one particular show that I did, and it was with Robert Parham. He is, I'm not sure, he's in Florida, and he has a title with one of the atheist organizations there, and I don't want to say the wrong organization or title.
Yeah, I think it was a humanist organization, if he's not on the board or president or something.
Yeah, and he is on the board of the Clergy Project. I was interviewing him, and he was telling me about a very dear friend of his who was also in the ministry. And this dear friend of his happened to be gay. And he was telling how this dear friend of his was going to treatments where he would sit in a chair and they would connect probes to places on his body. And they would show him pictures, and whenever his body had a response, he would get shocked.
Oh, my God.
With a painful shock. To train him that having homosexual responses is a wrong thing to do. And we talked to Robert Parham in episode 51 of Living After Faith, and to hear him tell that story, Daryl Ray called me and said, I'm in tears. I don't know how to deal with this. It was just to hear that story. And that's what we try to do with Living After Faith, is bring people to that place where they tell you something that hits you in the feels, that makes you make a decision. How do I feel about this? Or at least causes you to say, I need to think about how I think about this. I need to think about, you know, wow, I never thought about if someone, you know, can you possibly think it's a choice when you've got this guy being hooked up to electrodes, trying to save his job and his career and his life, and make all of that happen because he just cannot be gay? And can you say, well, just choose not to be?
Yeah.
You know, but you can't say that because it's not a choice. Mm-hmm. So a lot of where we try to go with Living After Faith is to get into that place where it gets inside your brain, where you've got to make a decision or think about something that maybe you haven't thought about before, or think about it in a way that you haven't thought about it before.
I think it's even more distressing because when you hear a story like that, this is the kind of thing you expect to read in a history book from things that we do in medieval torture. And you're thinking, wow, this is 2019 and this is happening now? That's the distressing part about this. Like, God, are we so barbaric still?
Yes.
Yeah, because of religion,
there,
right?
We are
terribly unfortunate to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really like to get into a related topic in a future show, which is of teens who are supposedly troubled getting sent off to these religious camps.
Yes, yes.
Because it's very much a similar topic. Oftentimes, what they mean by troubled at-risk youth, these religious programs, is they mean the kid is gay or wants to dye their hair green or doesn't believe in the religion fervently enough. And so, you know, similar to the Jesus camp story, which really exposed people to how terrible this kind of influence on children is, I think I would really like to get into the topic of teens being subjected to this kind of stuff, because it can be incredibly traumatizing for them. And, you know, I want to shed a light on it so we can hopefully get some attention toward topics like that and help people understand this is a real big problem and we can fight against it.
Mm-hmm. And what's even more mind-blowing about all this is how the religious influence can insert itself as some kind of an expert opinion. You know, it's a bit like these people that say, well, oh, yeah, I'm a sex addict. Oh, okay, and then, of course, I'll use Daryl Ray because Daryl Ray is just great for that. And Daryl would say, well, oh, who diagnosed you? Oh, my priest. Well, how the hell is he an expert in this? You know, and people don't stop for half a second to think about this. How the hell is your priest, your pastor, or your rabbi an expert in sexual matters all of a sudden? Exactly. They're not, right? Yeah, that's astonishing. Wow, good point.
Marriage counseling. How often do you have people going to various churches where before they get hitched, they have to go for pre-marriage counseling with a guy who's never been married? You know, in some cases, it's people who are celibate in their churches, like Catholic priests. But even pastors who are, you know, married in their church and it's okay with them. These aren't people who've been married a bunch of times or have any experience with relationship counseling. They're literally just giving their opinion because they're somehow chosen by God to do something. It's, you know, it's wild. Religion puts people up on a pedestal kind of for their God and makes them experts about things they know nothing about. And it is incredibly distressing.
To put that into proper perspective, I was a pastor for 20 years. 10 years of that, I was a senior pastor and would do that kind of counseling. Now, my marriage was an absolute disaster during the Pentecostal years. Don't know if you've heard this, but my story has been circulated pretty well. During the 20 years I was married, I had sex 12 times.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
That was what our marriage was like. And you can just draw from anything. I mean, that's all you need to know about it. It was just horrific. And, you know, so you've got the guy who's been married 20 years and had sex 12 times, and he's counseling new people who are getting married. What the hell does he know? What the fuck did I know? I knew nothing, man. Exactly. I'd have been happy for someone to tell me how to get laid, much less try to tell other people how to get laid.
Good stuff. Well, we can send you Nancy. Nancy's been married 9 times, but that's because she has a tendency to outlive or kill her ex-husband.
Well,
so
the thing about being counseled by a pastor, and I'd love to have your input on this, is that so many times when the man and woman are there in front of the pastor wants to emphasize to the woman that the man is the head of the household, and problems that she's experiencing, she's got to just stuff it and pay attention to what her husband wants. And she's given, you know, she's listened to because that's the pastor's job. But the advice that she's given is mostly to just knuckle under and go along with it. How did you treat those kinds of problems?
Our church was exactly the same way. The United Pentecostal Church is the most misogynistic organization that I think you probably could ever be associated with. It requires women, you cannot cut your hair, women can't wear makeup, can't wear jewelry, must wear dresses, no pants, always dresses. You know, the long hair, they stand out. There are all these things that are put on women that women have to do and bear the brunt of. And at the same time, the man's the head of the house. He's all this stuff. And that's what you see. You see a lot of women who respond back by saying, I'm just not going to put out, you know, and I know that sounds disrespectful. It sounds a lot of things. But when the only place that a person has power is to exercise the physical ability to say no, people are going to exercise that physical ability to say no. When the only source of power they have, the only place you give them a place that they can respond, and you tell them they can't respond there, but they figure out they can. See, that's another thing. You say, you have to do this. Well, a woman can say, you know what? I don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. And it can change. So a very misogynistic place to try to have a family, and a very constricted place for the women. And that puts men in a place that they find pretty unfortunate as well.
Mm-hmm. Deanna, I got to ask you, did you come out of apostasy as well, or were you raised secular?
I was raised mostly American Christian, which is, you know, pretty lackadaisical. But if you happen to say you don't believe in gods or Jesus or anybody, people, you know, tend to get their back up. I was lucky to have, aside from getting dragged to the Methodist church just about every week by my parents when I was young, and I hated dressing up. I hated getting up early in the morning.
Yeah.
I hated trying to sit through church with my tummy rumbling. You know, it was awful. But my experience with the evangelical church was what really turned me kind of against religion and turned me, like, helped me realize that most of my life I really hadn't believed that there was something there, but I was told by everyone it was there. So I had to kind of take that, like, well, I guess that's what everybody says. But, you know, I think a lot of it came from my love of reading, my love of science fiction. I was always watching Star Trek as a kid, and they had a wonderful society with no gods. And the times that there were supposed gods, like V'ger, there really weren't a god behind it. It was just something people were pointing to and saying, this is a god.
Yes.
So I loved that aspect of it, and that would continue to influence me throughout my life. And just the more I look into these claims that people are making, you know, somebody says the earth is 6,000 years old, and it's immediately obvious to me that they are wrong, but they believe it so fervently, and I can see the harm of it. So mm-hmm. I think that's what motivates me more, is like kind of the anti-theist reaction to religion, not any positive belief of my own about it.
So since Rich and I are being outnumbered by the number of women right here right now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask a question, since we got four ladies here. Let's ask a question to the ladies. Rich, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Ladies, Rich was saying there that basically a lot of women are subject and put the pressure from the church is to, you know your place as a woman and all that. Why do you think women seem to accept that role? And even in this day and age,
I think
after the liberation of women and everything.
From a very young age, it's conditioned into you that you aren't shown any other way.
Yeah, but I mean,
until you're older.
I can't speak as a woman, obviously, because I haven't been on the, I'm not on that side of the equation, right? But if somebody came to me and told me that your role is to be subservient to the opposite sex, which, let's face it, it kind of is.
I'd say yes.
I'm not sure what it would take for me to accept that. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what goes through a woman's mind to accept that position.
I think you know, Christina's it's conditioning that leads to low self esteem.
Yeah. And because having most of your role when you're a toddler.
Yeah, having most of your role models when you're young, your aunts who are being homemakers, the choice of toys having
the
to
dolls.
Do with caretaking others,
yeah.
You know, taking care of the dolls, learning to cook. And
when the
saying,
boys
no,
want to go out
not...
and play and run around, you know, you have to stay in here and help me make food.
Yeah, and when a little girl, at least used to be, you'd go to the store and they'd have girls' toys and boys' toys. And girls didn't wander off to the trucks and the jet planes and all of those action toys. No, no, you're going to come over here and have the Easy Bake, and you're going to have, you know, the tiaras.
I so wanted an Easy Bake oven as a boy.
So you're 3 and 4 and 5 when you're, you know, who you are is pretty well cemented in, and your view of the world. You know, those are critical years. And during those critical years, that's what you're taught. And unless you have enlightened parents, unless you have friends or you have other role models of women who are attorneys, you know, who are doctors, who not nurses, but who actually are doctors in the hospital and have lead roles, you really and truly don't understand what your role is going
and
to be when
also
you get older.
With taking stuff like learning your quote-unquote like place from like in relation to like men when you're growing up, and like your brother is like mean to you and your parents just say, oh, it's, you know, it's just boys being boys, but then you try to be mean back and they get mad at you, you learn that there's no point in sticking up for yourself.
They're protected. Deanna, do you concur?
I do concur, and Nancy had some really great points there. A big part of all of this is cemented by our culture, where when you're a kid, this is so, it surrounds you. It's everywhere, from the media that you see, the attitudes and the things that the adults say around you, the other kids. You know, I remember watching a documentary about gender roles and how they affect young children. And they started asking kids as young as 3 years old, boys and girls, asking them, like, you know, they'd give the boy like a pink shirt and say, here, you can have this pink shirt. And he would go, oh, no, I can't wear that. It's a girl shirt. And you could see like how strongly these roles are imprinted on people so young. And so, you know, you as a man, you've, your whole life, people have kind of let you do your thing. And, you know, I'm sure they've told you what to do an awful lot more than you wanted.
Oh, yeah.
But so if somebody came to you right now and said, you have to submit to everyone else around you, I mean, of course, it's ridiculous. But when your whole life you're told that, not directly, but through every form of more subtle communication, that you have to be not in the way of others, you have to keep them happy. And sometimes there's violent consequences. Yeah. Like, I can't tell you how many times that I have told a man he was doing something wrong in a very gentle way, and he got very angry and attacked me for it. How likely am I in the future to say, hey there, man person, you're doing something that is hurting me or whatever? Because I'm not going to risk that, right? So even when I'm at work, I work in a restaurant. And, you know, I'm walking down a hallway and somebody else comes around the corner toward me, and it's a man. And I am the one who, without even thinking about it, flattens myself up against the wall so he can walk calmly and confidently by. And I am an extremely enlightened and outspoken and, frankly, angry woman when it comes to these issues. And yet I still do that stuff automatically. It's wild. It's just, it's so ingrained.
I told you, especially the violence thing. We're subject to that here with Nancy all the time,
exactly.
Obviously. quick follow-up, ladies. Do you think this is maybe why women have somehow accepted unofficially the role of guardians of tradition?
I'm not sure.
Well, in the church, I mean, in Judaism, Christianity, I'm not that familiar with how it is with Islam and with Muslims, but that's the role in the church of the women to teach those traditions and to keep them going. The men are the leadership, and the women are the keepers of tradition.
You can't help but think it's almost like the slaves guarding the castle. You know, it's just absolutely amazing how religion has done that to women.
To expand on Deanna's, is that when girls are young, who's cooking? Who's cleaning? Who's got the vacuum cleaner? Yeah. Who's in the car schlepping the kids from one place to the other and making sure they've got the clean clothes? It's women. You turn the TV on, in general, who are the people that you see in leadership roles on TV? Mostly it's the men. So it's difficult, you know, to... I think it's easier
it's getting better
now for women you know, those women who are growing up. I mean, look at Congress at this point. Look at the number of women now who are taking over the Me Too movement.
Yes,
so much that's going on. We're not going back, but it's still not at the point where the majority of women have the strength and the self-esteem to say, I'm my own person. I can be whoever the hell I want to be. Deal with it.
Yes. Okay.
Amen,
cool.
Nancy. Amen.
All right. Well, guys.
Preach it, sister.
Excellent. So guys, coming up for Living After Faith, what's coming down the pipe for you guys?
That's a good question. Later today, we're recording our first episode of Loving After Faith. We're recording an interview for it, and Loving After Faith is just being launched now. This month is going to be its first episode, and Loving After Faith is my wife Deanna. She is that's really her project, but what she's going to do with Loving After Faith is discuss the ways that faith affects your loving relationships, your sexual relationships, your your passionate relationships, and how the changing of faith can change the passionate nature of the relationships and open new ideas. I mean, when I was a Christian, being in the fundamentalist group I was in, there were very few options. I mean, one man, one woman, and don't really have a good time, you two. You know, it was kind of you're making it too fun. So, you know, you change that into the Daryl Ray-esque, hey, who says that's wrong? Who makes that wrong? If that's not really wrong, then there's time, there's room, there's place to experiment and find out what you truly do. So that's my excitement, really, is in what Deanna's doing now, because I think that's a subject that we in Living After Faith have covered from time to time, but being able to cover it on a monthly basis is going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
I hope you guys send us the link so we can post that in the notes of the show.
Absolutely. We will send you anything we got.
Rich,
well,
Deanna?
I tell you what you need to do. You need to send yourselves up here and we'll pick a top. We'll go have lunch or breakfast. We'll pick a topic and we'll just have a good time enjoying each other's company while we do the
show. We'll just kidnap them. They'll just become Canadians. Yeah. Don't even go back to Seattle.
I would love to be a Canadian.
I would love to be a Canadian.
It's wonderful.
The United States is something of the past.
Wonderful.
It's, you know, that country's falling apart.
Yeah, we'll take you to Timmy's and introduce you to Timbits.
Rich, Deanna, thank you.
Back in the day, I had a girlfriend in Canada, and I've been to Timmy's. I like Timmy's. Oh,
Rich, Deanna, thank you so much for being on the show today. Please send us the links and all that. So the show is Living After Faith and a multitude of other shows as well. Please follow them. These guys are great. And before I let you go, though, I got to have you say hi. This is Rich and Deanna from Living After Faith, and we took a left at the valley.
This is Deanna Joy Lyons.
I'm Rich Lyons.
We took a left at the valley.
Fantastic.
That was perfect.
Yay, we practiced.
And that was Rich and Deanna.
Our new best friends.
Yep.
New best friends. We make a lot of friends, don't we?
We do make a lot of friends.
We make a lot of new best friends.
So the show is Living After Faith, and there's going to be a lot more shows, Love After Faith and all that stuff. So take a look into them, guys. They're fantastic people, and we love them. And we'll be on their show soon, which should be fun, too.
Yeah. they really are extremely ambitious in the topics that they want to cover on a regular basis.
Exactly.
More power to them. That's fantastic.
Absolutely. And exactly. More power to them, and we wish them all the best luck, and we'll be keeping a close eye on them. And, you know, it'll become just another one of those sister shows that we have that we like to encourage people to listen to.
Our listeners to cross over.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. To them, for sure.
The more of us go out there and start speaking truth to power, the more of us are going to come out of the closet.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of this, right? To realize, you know, that you're not alone. That's the whole point of it. Well, thank you so much, guys, for joining us on the show today. Thank you, ladies, for being with me.
Our pleasure.
Lots of fun.
You can follow us on leftatvalley.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at LETV Podcast. You can send us an email on leftatvalley@outlook.com. Send your complaints to Nancy on the third floor, but make sure to duck once she throws a knife back at you. Give us a 5-star review wherever you find us. It really helps us and helps others find the show. Coming up next week, we'll have our Chris the Christian Christensen versus John the Godless Engineer on the debate of the historicity of Jesus.
That should be good.
It's not going to be an Oxford style dictionary, like a dictionary.
Debate.
God, I can't speak today to save my life. Like we did last time with Robert Stanley, it's going to be more of a conversation between the two. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd change things up for Chris, because you know when they have Oxford-style debate, that kind of really helps the Christian put out everything on the table, and then you kind of have to answer to it. No, I want Chris to be more on his toes and actually have a conversation with John. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be interesting. After that, we have the ladies from Forsaking Faith.
Yay! Yay!
Coming back and talk about, is the Bible actually good literature?
Looking forward to that.
Yes. And then we'll have Zach from the Zachary Podcast. Zachrilege Podcast. He'll be with us. And then, of course, after that, we'll have the legendary Matt Dillahunty.
Waiting for that one.
We'll be closing the month of February with the guys from Godless Heathen Podcast.
Oh,
yeah.
That's going to be fun, too.
We better get a lot of sleep before that one.
Yes. And then, of course, we get into March, where we'll be having our 5th year celebration.
Wow.
5 years of Left of the Valley. Can you believe it?
No, neither can I,
actually.
You know, when we, and I say we, although it was your show, and I was only on it for a while, but did you envision being here 5 years?
No.
We thought a year if it goes well.
If it goes well, you know, and two, because I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
And it just...
Two, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And it just, you know, it really, really has changed my life. My life would not be at all where I am right now if it wasn't for this little show. So, God knows.
Yeah, and I agree.
We're actually approaching close to 250 episodes, I think, now.
Wow.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, anyway, thank you so much, guys. Anything else we need to add?
Thanks to the listeners for keeping us going.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And thanks to the listeners for correcting our mistakes.
Yes. We love you, Paul.
Thank you to Paul. Thank you so much, guys. Until next time. The system is broke down, working backwards
in the only action of tactic. I'm
not putting out there 3 more podcasts just to compete with them, okay? I have my hands full with this one.
See, the secret is that I outsource all of the work to the men in this group, and then I just, you know, lay back in bed and talk about sex with people. So, you know.
Hey, my kind of girl.
Hell yeah. You gotta fight those gender roles.
That's the thing. They already do that to me here, too. So, come on, guys.
Sorry, honey. We just gotta train you for the next generation. Yeah. It's important to balance these things out.
So we'll be living in a world of Amazon women ruling over men.
That's my snow. I'm an atheist.